Welcome to another episode of the Tactical Leadership Podcast, where we focus on building better businesses. I believe in order to be the best leader that you can be, you must be willing to be the first follower and have a servant mentality when you're in a leadership position. If you want to be the best leader that you possibly can be sure to stay tuned and listen to industry leaders and hear how they built winning cultures in their own businesses. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Tactical Leadership. Today, I'm speaking with Laura DiBenedetto, and we're going to talk about how she helps people master their mentality. Before we begin, I remind you this show is brought to you by Knightly Productions. If you want to create tactical content that delivers, head over to knightly.productions to see how we can help you multipurpose your podcast, YouTube channel, or content you are creating. Laura, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you. It's awesome to spend Sunday morning with you.
You know, I'm so excited. We cut up for way too long before the show, and I think this is going to be a really fun conversation. And before we get into it, I want to give the audience just a little bit of background on you, where you're a TEDx speaker, you're number one bestselling author of The Six Habits and Life Mastery Coach. You teach how to create the life of your dreams without sacrificing what you love. You founded and are the CEO of Vision Advertising, a company you built at a ripe old age of 19, and you've helped hundreds of entrepreneurs build and grow enterprises entirely on their own terms. And there's so much to unpack across all of that, and I think we're really going to have a great conversation about it. But before we really dive into that, tell the audience something you'd like them to know about yourself.
Sure. I get no greater satisfaction than when I can actually see someone's eyes light up from that epiphany of, oh my God, I can do this. Oh my God, I can have it. And even better, oh my God, I did it. That's my fave.
I love that. And I think that's a great piece of what we're really going to be talking about, because your journey, especially from 19, I mean, you have, you know, way back, you know, from bullying, abuse, bankruptcy, burnout, you overcame all of that. You started a business and you retired at 37, a ripe old age of 37. And you've got so much going. So kind of describe to us a little bit about that journey. What got you motivated at 19 to do something like that? And then what got you motivated to retire that young, where you have a long, long life still to live beyond that retirement?
Honestly, I always like to preface this by saying, anyone that's listening, if you think, oh my God, she started a business at 19 and she started or she retired at 37. Wow. If you've put me on a pedestal for even 2 seconds, I'm going to go ahead and step off that. Because honestly, it's all so humble and it's so just very human. So at 19, I had, oh, this is embarrassing, but check my tax returns. I had 14 jobs in 1 year. I quit half and I got fired from the other half. And my desire to be an entrepreneur was really based in, I am so sick of working for these idiots that want to pay me peanuts and make me do monkey work. I am sick of this. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I want to be paid well and I'm going to figure it out. So that's what I did. I figured it out. And I can't even tell you the volume of mistakes I made along the way and the crazy stuff I learned and everything. But I don't know. Everybody has a humble story. And I think that one of the things that really probably annoys me about a lot of the folks that you listen to out there, they just seem so damn untouchable. And that's one of the things that I really take pride in my book and in my story is I'm so painfully average. It's not even funny. And that is magical because I've done cool, extraordinary stuff just being ordinary. And I want to encourage other people to do the same. So I started this business at 19 and I did all these things. And most of it was just a strong desire to do things my way. I didn't want to be told what to do. I remember working for this guy who constantly took credit for my work. And I was like, well, you suck. I don't want to do this anymore. You make me feel like crap. Oh, and you pay me like 10 bucks an hour. No, I'm smarter than that. And I want a lot of money, not just a little money. And this whole struggle thing, no. So a lot of it is just stubborn refusal to just allow other people's to see me as less than what I really am and what I'm really capable of. And I've always known that I'm smart, stubborn, and unwilling to cooperate sometimes, but very smart. And to be honest with you, I know your listeners are probably the same way, like stubborn, hello, entrepreneurs, I see you, you know, law enforcement, hello. But You're really smart too. So the retirement at 37, that was a journey that I began somewhere between like 30 and 32. It was years of hustle and grind and all these terms that I actually think are quite negative. You ever grind something and you notice it slowly whittles up and disappears? Grind is not a positive term. And we use that in business, but that's what I did. It basically, for years, I chased this big thing of success. And I got it, but I kind of had to sell my soul to do it. And I burnt myself out and I could see the burnout. I could feel the burnout. My health was starting to suffer. I was really fighting like crazy with my first husband. I was just like, wow, this really sucks. So I wanted to get out. I was like, I built this thing, but it's killing me. And it was killing me because I was doing it wrong. I didn't know that at the time. I could only see that in the rearview mirror. I built this company that had become this noose around my neck. And I knew that I had to get out. So of course I asked myself the questions, do I just quit? Do I sell the company? Do I close the company? Do I sell it and remain like a silent equity partner? Like, what do I do? And I decided that I wanted to sell 49% equity of my company to someone that wouldn't have to buy in, but earn in. That way I could retain equity for as long as possible. I could train them and make sure that they're actually ethical and honest and all that other stuff. And I found her when I was 35, and this makes me so happy. She fired me at 37. I was like, oh my God, thank you. She's like, Laura, we love you. You need to go. Okay. See ya. So I succeeded despite myself, and it was the only time I've ever been thrilled about being fired.
And it's interesting where I see a lot about your content where you're America's happiness coach, and something you just mentioned, especially in the advertising, and I'm in that marketing world where you create stuff on social media and people see social media and they think it's this glam life, right? And there's so much non-authenticity attached to what people are doing, but you're talking about like being happy and being yourself, which is what you decided to do at an early age. Talk to us about like how those correlate, how being your authentic self really kind of highlights that happiness or helps drive you towards finding that happiness.
Sure. Well, have you ever had a job or a position where you had to conduct yourself in a certain way that was counter to how you actually are?
Yeah, it's called the Army, where I have to act professional all the time.
Damn it. And how fulfilled do you feel when you have to pretend to be something other than who you truly are?
It gets miserable when, you know, you have that image you have to uphold, right? I know a lot of the listeners understand that, where you have that image that is expected of you, right? And you have to act in that certain fashion.
Right. Now, what's the sub message of that? It's that you, as you are insufficient to what they want. That's the undertone. And that sucks. Who could feel good about themselves when they constantly have to change into something else to be accepted? And that was for me it. I mean, no offense to corporate America, but it's definitely where I don't belong. I say the word fuck entirely too much to fit in. So I was like, well, you know, I'll be working at the company. I'm just going to run it. Then I can do what I want. But it's integral for us to be who we are. I mean, you know, I know, you know, you've got a significant other in your life, and as well do I. Nothing makes us feel more joyful than when we get to be loved and accepted for who we are, not who our partner wants us to be, or who our bosses want us to be, or who our clients want us to be. And we just get to be ourselves. So I think I'm a very difficult person to be married to, but my husband can comment on that. I once upon a time was probably not a great boss, because I just had, I had put myself through so much, and I was tired and not really still living in authenticity. Cause I remember at 19, I had all these well-meaning older folks telling me how to conduct myself. At 20, you can't wear that. Oh, you're wearing too much makeup. Your heels are too high. This, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Shut it down. I'm going to do what I want to do. And if you don't like it, don't buy from me. It's that simple, but I need to be me. So like at this point in my life, I am so adamantly passionate about being myself. And if anyone even starts to like suppress that in any way, I'm like, nope, I'm out. See ya. And it's a weird place to be. And it makes you like when you get to this place, it makes you realize how valuable and special you truly are. And not from an egocentric place, but from a place of like, God made me this way. I'm not an accident. God made me this way for a reason, because the world needs this. And maybe only a few people need this, but this that I am is what is needed on this planet at this time. And I don't need to change who I am. And I think our happiness is a really big indicator. It's like the red light on your dashboard going off, you know, the check engine light. It's important. If you're not happy, if you're constantly having to mold yourself to make your wife happy, or constantly like try to change yourself so you can sell stuff, it's going to erode your well-being after a while, and it's going to fatigue you. So we have to pay attention to that.
And that's such a difficult thing to do, especially given, and we'll just use myself personally as that background, where I like to kind of correlate to things that are identifiable from something that's coming from my background, where you're a police officer, it's your identity, right? You're in the military, that's your identity. So when you talk about transitioning out of that world and finding, I guess, having that vulnerability to make the boundaries and say, here is what I want, what I expect. There's a level of self-mastery attached to being okay making those boundaries, right? But also a level of expectation where you have to, I guess, voice that, you have to communicate that, right? Is there that level of communication where a good way to go about saying, hey, this is who I am and what I am, or fuck it, this is what's up, right? What is that level of communication that you encourage?
It depends on who you really are, really. If you're more of a fuck it person, go that way. If you're more of a, well, now this is more the way I am, then do it that way. But you mentioned something so important that I really want to touch upon and really just kind of pick apart for a second. You said that if you're a police officer, if you're in the military, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a husband or a dad or whatever, that's your identity. I'd like to lovingly correct you. That's your role. It's a difference. And this is important that we understand the difference between identity and role. And I'll tell you why. Identity is who you are. Your roles are what you do. They are the things that define your relationships with other people and the tasks you have. So my roles are wife, author, speaker, coach, leader, boss, daughter, friend, furry pet mom, right? I am all of these roles. My roles actually don't define me. My identity lives in its own sacred space. And my identity are the adjectives that describe me. My identity is I'm kind, I'm funny, I'm irreverent, I'm passionately committed to certain things, I'm creative, I love to travel. My identity is who I am at my core, my adjectives, what I love, what I care about. Like, I care about ethics, and I care about integrity and spirit and soul and serving people. That's my identity. Now, this is really, really important in the happiness department, but let's ground this in the subject of leadership. When we separate the idea of identity and role, then we actually become bulletproof in the tasks we have before us. So if in law enforcement, you're dealing with some dude that's like beating on his wife or whatever, and then he starts attacking you, you suck, and you know, why are you doing this to me? Whatever. He's only attacking your role. Your identity remains sovereign. And if you merge the two, you might mistakenly believe this person and let it get to your subconscious and really erode your well-being. But if you're like, no, you can hate me in my role. Absolutely. 100%. My identity is off limits to you, buddy. You do what you want. Now, example from entrepreneurship. You have to make cold calls. That is no fun. Even seasoned sales veterans like myself hate it. I still hate it, but I do it. And when I realize and always remind myself, like, this is like the ultimate like mental sticky note, constantly reminding myself, all right, I got to make some sales calls right now. This is a job in my role. It's important. And my identity is still sovereign. If they say no to me, I'm still a good person. If they hang up on me, I'm still funny. If they, you know, are rude to me, I am still the person that loves kitties and doggies and whatever. And if if I don't make a sale, I'm still an awesome human being worthy of love because that's my identity. It's just my role. They rejected my role, not my identity. So this separation of identity versus role is a way to make ourselves more bulletproof, more capable, and really start to like dive deep into the work that I want to help people with, which is the identity. The identity and the six habits and all of that stuff, they're very intrinsically tied. Your role, that's your jam. You figure out what you're supposed to do. And, you know, if you can put both of them in their own little baskets, you're actually going to be healthier, happier, and more successful in your roles.
And that's a difficult, I guess, correlation to make, right? I appreciate you setting that context around it because I've never heard anybody explain it in that fashion, right? Where they always talk about you lose your identity when you leave, you lose a business, right? Especially here in COVID, right? If you've had a business for 10 years and you lost a business, well, you lost your identity. And people, so many people correlate that. So I appreciate that you kind of broke those two discerning points across. And a lot of what you talk about and teach are like toxic habits that people have and identifying toxic habits. And I, a lot of that is that negative self-talk, right? Where, you know, I lost this, this, and this, or even a victim mindset attached to things. What are those toxic habits that you see the most, or maybe even those blind spots that people are missing attached to things that kind of tear them down?
So there's six mental habits that I teach, and people probably don't even think about this consciously, but most things have a dark side and a light side. And I'll give you the dark sides first. You ever like need to do something or go to the gym and you psych yourself up into going there? You would probably say things like, come on, you piece of shit. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. That is actually toxic to your well-being. You don't realize it. Yes, it motivates you to go do the thing, but it doesn't give you lasting motivation and it doesn't make you want to do it. It makes you ashamed not to do it. So that's something that we need to think about. And when you constantly do this for years and years and years and years to yourself, you are living in a constant state of escaping shame. Okay. And shame is really, honestly, yeah, it's a valuable tool, but it'll make you want to kill yourself. So, you know, I use that tool. It's the dark side of the habit of kindness. Kindness is the light habit. When we're kind to ourselves, it's like going to the gym, motivating yourself would sound more like, come on, you deserve to go to the gym. Come on, you want those muscles. You can do this. Get up, get out of bed, get off the couch, put your sneakers on. You got this. Come on. Today's the day you're going to have your personal best. Come on. When you live in a state of chronic unkindness, which actually most of us do, a lot of leaders, a lot of military, a lot of law enforcement, a lot of people in that space, you spur yourself on to make the call to do the thing, to do the hard things by virtue of tearing yourself down versus building yourself up. Now, if any of you have any experience with a three-year-old, you'll know that doesn't work. And inside of us is just a quivering little three-year-old that wants to be loved. You get more out of a three-year-old when you say, come on, sweetie, you can do it, versus you short little piece of crap, let's go, right?
I have a five-year-old goddaughter. Yes, that is so right.
Right. So, you know what? We get older, we grow up, and we don't realize that we don't have our mom and dad or foster parents or however we were raised to be there to cheer us on and help us do things. We have to do it for ourselves. And inside of us is just a child. We're just giant children walking around doing adult stuff. That's why we say things like, yeah, I'm adulting today. Yay. Right. But if we actually honor the fact that there is a small human inside of us that just wants to be nurtured and loved, then we realize, oh, damn it. I have been remarkably unkind to myself, but I think kindness would get me further. Nope. And doing it once does not work. It needs to be your mental default treatment of yourself by yourself. So the second one is acceptance, right? When we compare ourselves to others, you know, maybe there's another entrepreneur around us. They've achieved more. They've made more money. You see another husband, his wife is prettier than yours. And you're like, damn it. You know, or like whatever it is that's bugging you, when you're comparing yourself to others, or you're even comparing yourself to, you know, what you want out of yourself, and you're just living in chronic disappointment of the choices you've made and how you feel like you could go further and do more. again, doesn't encourage the little kid inside of you. So you have, and you know what? It's so funny. Like the toughest people on the planet sometimes have a hardest time acknowledging what I'm saying and really acknowledging, like, I don't care how big and bad you are. There's still a little kid inside of you. And that little bugger needs love. And no, they don't need love. They need discipline. No, they need both. Don't do that. You're going to erode your well-being. So when you don't accept yourself, it sounds like, you know, just constantly beating yourself. I can't believe I did that. Oh my God, I'm such a screw up. Oh my God. Like, what's wrong with me? You know, versus, yeah, I screwed up. That's okay. I learned. Or, yep, 10 pounds overweight. Apparently I'm allergic to the gym. Cool. You know what I mean? You just love yourself regardless.
And I think that's such a difficult thing to do. And you kind of hit on it. The big tough guys are always the ones that are, I think, the worst at this, because the pride and the ego gets attached to it, right? That alpha mindset where we're quote unquote better than that, right? Which starts that circle of negative self-talk, right? I'm better than that. So I shouldn't be feeling X, Y, and Z, right?
Right, exactly. And like, oh, well, I'm better than this self-help stuff. I don't need this stuff. But you've heard the phrase, and it's true. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. And I think actually, for all the men listening, you know this. You've been socialized not to cry when you're sad. You've been socialized to stuff your feelings. You've been socialized to dismiss these things as weak and girly. I got news for you. Women are tough as hell. So, you know, fight like a girl. Okay. You're welcome. No problem. Like, women are tough as hell. You try squishing a watermelon out the hole the size of a lemon and tell me how tough and badass you are. So like, there is value in acknowledging this stuff. And it doesn't mean it's work you need to do on a public stage. Sometimes it's work you just keep front and center. I mean, take a look at David Goggins. I mean, come on, he did self-work. And he's like the toughest dude on the planet. Why are you immune?
Yeah, well, he's psychotic. I mean, there's a whole different level of person for him.
That's true.
And I absolutely love that, because it's one of those that I think, again, like a lot of us struggle with, right? A lot of us think that vulnerability is a weakness instead of it actually being a strength. And I think a lot of that comes from like the fear of being rejected, right? I'm scared to show these feelings because this is not my identity, quote unquote, or my role. This is not what's expected of me. So we're scared to show our feelings to that capacity. And then it turns into, instead of conquering that fear, right? Fear to me is like, the Army loves acronyms. So it's like false evidence appearing real. And that's,
I know that one,
you know, and that's something that I really believe, where courage isn't not having fear. Courage is acting in the face of fear, right? When you're feeling that fear and you can show that courage, show that vulnerability, that's when I think the most growth could really happen and the most healing to this context, right?
Correct. And you know what? I'll give you a great example to really drive your point home. You're having an argument with your spouse. What takes more courage? Saying, I screwed up. I owe you the biggest apology and I have to work on this. Or screw you, I don't need you anymore. What takes more courage? The vulnerability. That's the biggest, bravest thing we can ever do. And we got to be vulnerable ourselves. So I know we're running short on time here. So I'll kind of like put these other four in a quick little bullet form for you. So the dark sides, when we take all the things in our life for granted, we just complain. When we are distracted as hell, which happens, hello, smartphones, I'm looking at you. And when we are allowing way too much toxic input to come in, social media and the news and other people's opinions, like, well, shut up. And then the final one is when we're just kind of aimless and we're doing what other people tell us to do. So a lot of people do that. Now, the light sides of these, the six habits I help teach people and help them to master, gratitude in all things, gratitude for the terrible situations in your life, gratitude for the tragedies, like profound gratitude. Like, I'm not talking about like writing down like little stuff at the end of the day. You're just writing for the sake of writing. Look at me, I did my gratitude list. No, I mean lifestyle stuff. Everything that I talk about is a lifestyle. So gratitude, then you've got the habit of presence and actually truly being with something. Great example for you. I lived in Hawaii for a year and a half, just moved to Florida. And you know what I saw while tourism was still alive and well? I would sit on the beach appreciating the hell out of the sunset and watching all those glorious colors and that splendor of nature on full display and like totally in awe. And then I would look to my right and I'd see all these tourists missing the sunset because they were so obsessed with getting the perfect selfie in the perfect pose or just capturing the right moment with the green flash and this and that, and not actually stepping away from the damn camera phone to appreciate. You miss life when you don't appreciate it. So presence in tragedy, presence in joy, presence in the things that are hard for us, right? Then you got the habit number five, which is the habit of goodness. You know bad stuff is going in your head. You know it. It's your job to repel it. I do not watch the news. Hell no. And I avoid social media because it is toxic as hell. And it's my job. It's not my fault that the world is toxic, but it is my fault if I invite it in. And it's my fault if I sit on my couch and like, yeah, my life is boring. But it can be my responsibility if I choose to add good things to my life. Like, you know what? I feel like going to the coast today. I'm going to go see some seashells or whatever. And then the final habit, intention. That's when we're not aimless. We're very clear about what we want and we take little big actions towards it. And we don't let our excuses screw us over. Oh, I can't do this because, or, oh, this is too big. You know what? Nobody sat down and ate an elephant in one sitting. One bite at a time, y'all. Like, you have to do the baby steps. And intention is really about knowing what you want, why you want it, how you're going to get it, and then just moving forward. Even if the only thing you got to do that day is just get dressed, it's moving forward.
And it sounds like, obviously, you've put a lot of these steps together in your own life. Has there been any resources you'd recommend? Obviously, your book is a great piece we'll talk about and give a link to here in a second. But is there anything you've used to kind of like craft this as you've moved along? Any resources you'd recommend?
Honestly, therapy would be a great tool for a lot of people because when you live in a state of unkindness to yourself, that's some crap you need to work out with someone that can hold space for you, and your friends can't do it because they're not equipped to hold that kind of space to go to the deep, dark, and ugly places. You know, my book has lots of companion tools that go free with it. So when you get the book, there's like all this like great coaching stuff that's completely free. So yes, do that. But I think therapy is really important. If you treat yourself like crap, if you refuse to accept yourself and you hold yourself to an impossible standard, you know, you can't reach, and you just live in like this dreck and just terrible blackness, and you're still moving forward anyway, but essentially just waiting to die. You got to work that out. You got to figure out where it's coming from. Because what it will do is actually help prepare you for the coaching tools that I give with the book. It'll prepare you to like really look at these things and have that moment of, yeah, I deserve better. And I know I can do it. And I actually have enough self-awareness now to know where my toxic crap is coming from. So I know where to shine the light to see where to begin.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And I think that's another huge point that should really be highlighted to those from my background, where having that objective person, and of course being selective about who you're talking to, because we all have that preconceived notion that they just won't understand what we've been through, which a lot of times can be true, but still having that objective third party to kind of talk through some of those issues, I think, is invaluable to your point. And knowing that you're going through all this, you're sharing all this, you're writing the books, you're giving these speeches, what's a legacy you're wanting to leave in the world with everything you're putting out there?
Actually, I really want to leave a big legacy, and it's honestly, it's not even about ego. I got to tell you, most of my life, I always chased like things that pumped me up, like ego. Now it's like the opposite. I genuinely don't care. Like if somebody recognizes me, I mean, that's more awkward than great. So it's like, hello. But the legacy I want to leave actually is making this planet better, but in a very specific way. So if you take a look at people that abuse their spouses, people that abuse their employees, people that abuse power, people that abuse their role in public service and control others and manipulate information, these people are damaged. Healthy people don't do those things. So, you know, if you take a look at someone that feels really, really good about themselves, they like who they are, they live in gratitude and joy, they're present, right? And they're living with intention and only inviting good things in. Do you really see that person beating the crap out of their wife No. Do you see that person like having like a major alcohol problem or whatever? No, because there's no sorrows to drown. Do you see like someone who feels really amazing about themselves feeling the need to like stand on the necks of their employees versus lift them up or like steal from constituencies? No. So what I'm trying to do is reach 1 billion with a B people and help people to realize there's a better way and invite them to do it. I want people to be in a state of security with themselves and with life. If you take a look at like most of the evils in the world, people will say, oh, the root of all evil is money. No, it's not. Oh, the root of all evil is greed. No, it's not. Look below those. Where do those come from? Where do the desire for money and the behavior of greed come from? It comes from a state of insecurity and not feeling secure. Secure that I have a place in this world. Secure that I matter. Secure that I actually do have enough money. I'm good. Secure that you're worth being here, right? And secure that life is working for you, not against you. And when people don't live in a state of security, they act like shit. Towards themselves and towards others. However, when we operate from a place of security, we see a lot of problems go away. Like, you know, Portugal, they made all drugs legal and they introduced lots of programs to actually make it so people don't need drugs. Therapy and tools and actually building up a broken person so you don't need drugs. You make better choices because you don't feel desperate. So my goal is to reach and change the lives of 1 billion people. I don't know if I'll do it before I'm dead. I really want to. That's why chatting with you on your show is so important. I really want to motivate people. Please read the book, have the epiphanies, realize, God, it could be better. I could be part of the change I want to see in the world. And this is really where it comes from. Holy moly. Huh. So if I change, I can maybe motivate my partner to like want to change themselves and just by virtue of being so happy and successful and then maybe they can have a chain effect. So that's my big goal.
That is a big, hairy, audacious goal that I absolutely love. And the impact attached to, you know, I talk a lot about self-mastery, but a lot of that ties into being happy with yourself. So I absolutely love that you're on that goal and on that journey. Share with the audience, where can they find your content? Where can they reach out to you? Where can they find your book? What's the best way to go about that?
So I like to joke about this. I have 2 places that people can find me. If you're brave and think you can spell, you can go to lauradibenedetto.com. If not, there's the easier version. You can go to thesixhabits.com. It's T-H-E-S-I-X habits.com. And go there, learn about the book. You can watch my TED talk. You can learn about my marketing company. You can basically jump into all things happiness related.
Awesome. I absolutely love it. And I want to encourage the audience, go over there, find this content, and then tune back in this Friday where we're going to talk with Laura more about a 90-day habit mastery program that will help you along this journey for everything we talked about today. Laura, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Tactical Leadership Podcast, and I hope you got a ton of value out of what we talked about today. I also want to remind you that this show is brought to you by Night Protection Services. If you're a leader in a small to mid-sized business that does $5 to $10 million a year in revenue and want to improve retention costs, which could actually add up to being twice your employee's salary, all through creating a safer work environment and saving up to 25% in insurance costs, be sure to visit nightprotectionllc.com.